Hey, welcome back, everybody. This is That Weird Show, and I am, of course, that weird host, The Shadow. And tonight I've got a pretty interesting show, and it's one that I actually believe in, and I kind of feel like, you know, need to be said and have a few things pointed out to try to help get the field become more respected as far as, you know, the evidence that we gather. And before I do that, I do want to do a couple of real quick shout outs. And the first one being that this show is being streamed on Parapost Network Central. If you don't know what that is a podcasting platform where you can go over there on Facebook and check out all kinds of podcasts out there. There's some about music, there's some about TV shows, and of course, paranormal and conspiracy theory. But it's not just that. If you have a show of your own and you would like to stream to Parapost and reach a whole nother spectrum of audience, reach out to them, and Ryan Laverty or one of the volunteers for Parapost will get back to you and get your show on Parapost, and it is completely free. So again, Parapost Network Central. The next one is that this show is sponsored by Health Empowers You, and this is a website you can go to and get some recipes and some food items. And this is going to be a continuous project. This will grow as time goes on. But right now they have a PDF of over 200 smoothie recipes, some for losing weight, some for cognitive function, others for, you know, immune boosting. And if you want, once you get there and you find something that you like and you're in that checkout, be sure to take a swing in that promo code at TWS05. Yeah, let me get that up there. It's on the bottom of the screen, TWS05, and get 5% off your order. So again, that is healthempoweredyou.net. Check them out. Let health empower you. And tonight, I have somebody with me to talk about some of the technologies and things regarding examining evidence when it comes to the paranormal. He is the host of the Killer Pros podcast and also Ghost Hunting Advice. He is also a publisher. He's got a lot on his plate, and he also worked with forensic. So he definitely has a very solid view and some great advice for what we can do with our evidence and how to better examine them. And ladies and gentlemen, help me welcome Channer Rutledge.
Hey guys, how's it going?
Well, thanks for stopping by. I mean, you and I, we've talked before about investigative technique. And before we get into that, why don't you tell people a little bit more about who you are and some of your past experience that definitely is going to be very relevant for what we're talking about tonight.
Yeah, absolutely. So I host a podcast called Ghost Hunter Advice. Basically, it's a resource that I wanted to put out that it's the thing that I wish that I had when I started doing this coming up on maybe 25 years ago, 20 to 25 years ago, started investigating the paranormal. Before starting the podcast, I was a private investigator, licensed private investigator for 15 years. I got cases ready for court, worked with several people in forensics, digital forensics, video and photo reconstruction and enhancement for certain cases, especially involving theft or involving missing persons from security cameras. And you know how bad those are. But did that for 15 years, worked my way up in the industry, was over a special investigations unit, handled a lot of child welfare and child custody cases, especially those involving custodial interference. So like missing kids, one parent loses custody and takes off with the child. We found them, recovered the child, sometimes working with law enforcement, sometimes on our own. And then in the paranormal world, while I was doing that, I was also investigating this on the down low, tried to keep my name and face out of this because it does affect, you know, you going into court. Right. You never want an attorney to bring that up when you're sitting on stand, especially on a big case where somebody's life is, you know, going to be altered by the outcome of it. About the time that I started moving away from that, I started being more public and I started Ghost Hunter Advice, the podcast. And it's just kind of gone from there. I've been investigating for a long time. I've done everything from, you know, your standard going in, a family calls you to investigate a home, to doing stuff involving more call-ins by clergy and business, and then doing things for publication.
Right. Now, in regard to tonight, mm-hmm. how from your experience, how important is it that we do the best we can to obtain the most clear video or photographic evidence in the paranormal?
So this is where it gets fuzzy, because most answers are going to be, and it depends. It depends right. on what your goal is. If you're going out and you're having fun, and I talk about this on my show, there's nothing wrong with being a hobbyist and going out and just enjoying the spooky season in a graveyard, or going out and doing things like that. That's more about the feeling. That's more about seeing stuff and getting, giving evidence for yourself. But right. if you are going into homes, if you're going into businesses and you're putting yourself forward as a professional paranormal investigator, and you're getting this together for a client, or you're doing serious research, getting clear evidence, whether it's video or audio, is absolutely one of the most important things you can do. As a private investigator, I did a ton of surveillance work. I did a lot of stuff that involved cameras, a lot of things that involved video, both video and still. And a lot of times the decisions of the court hinged on how good the video quality is. And with right. technology being as good as it is now, you know, we all see those old photos of Bigfoot where everything's grainy from like analog yeah. photos and stuff. And that's the way it was when I started. But now, I mean, we can get 4K video from something about, well, you can't see that because it's on a green screen, but that size. There's really no excuse to have the bad, shaky, grainy video when we have so many tools at our disposal.
Right. Now, I remember, you know, even when I first started investigating just 5 years ago, you know, the camera I was working with, I was thinking, oh, wow, this is going to be great. It's going to be awesome. And then 6 months later, I see something come out and everything is like so much better. And mm-hmm. next thing I know, I got, you know, I'm looking at all my equipment and I can see the progression of the gear that I buy. And I realize that while spending all that money on good equipment, it certainly does help. But I've learned that a lot of it also depends on what I do, mm-hmm. where I place the camera, where am I thinking about the lighting, environmental conditions. I mean, I remember the first time I tried to do a cold investigation, and it was cold, and the lens on my camera kept fogging up. And even when I think I got it cleared, when I take a picture, because I'm looking at the screen and it's so small, I can't see those small, subtle hints of fog reappearing until I get at home and I've got it on my computer screen. Mm-hmm. And now I've got like all these slew of photos that I've just completely wasted 30 seconds on, you know, which may not seem like a lot of time, but I mean, that's a lot of memory space, you know, and that's a lot of things to go through. What are some of the things that you would recommend to somebody to have on them when dealing with the potential of environmental, you know, interference?
So when it comes to that, I like to use a couple of different types of camera. That way, if one of them goes down or one of them ends up not being, you know, what's needed for that particular situation, you do have backups and you have options. I like the GoPro style cameras. They get pretty clear video and you can get up to 4K. Even at 1080p, you're getting good crisp stuff in nighttime. Now with those, I also like to crack them open because this is a good cheap way to get some night vision, and something you can use with an external light source so that you can preserve your own night vision. Yeah. You can crack those things open and take out the filter. And that's because what the filter does is it blocks out the IR lights and the UV lights. So you can break out that little piece of glass, and then you have a full spectrum camera there that you can run infrared lights with, or you can run UV lights with, if you've got a full spectrum setup. And you can pick those up from anywhere from $50 to $100. If they get broken or damaged, it's not really that big of a deal to fix them. The biggest thing is when you're putting those back together, I do not glue the lenses, because it allows me to manually focus that lens right. if I want to focus on something farther away or closer right. up. I'd also have a tablet or something that you can just run a line in so that you have a larger screen to adjust that. Right. When it comes to camcorders, I do like to have a handheld camcorder with me. I'm a big fan of Canons. I also like Sony's. They have a type of camera, it's called prosumer grade. It's in between like the big movie style cameras and things that you would film a documentary with, and the things that you would.
Yeah, kind of like the black web cameras.
similar.
Yeah, not Black Web, but Black Magic.
Yeah, and I can't ever remember the number on it. It's like Sony AX something.
Yeah,
but it is it's a handheld camcorder. We use this for surveillance a lot because it was 4K. And it was so clear that if we used the night shot mode with that and we had a Streamlights IR flashlight, we could get license plates up to half a mile away.
Nice. You know, real quick, I do appreciate Joanna here for stopping by. And if you can, just hit share one time. So, as far as the whole thing with using with night vision cameras and IR light, this was something that I had to learn the hard way. And when I first got my video camera, it is the Zohu 4K camera. And I picked this up on Amazon. It was for like, I think I only paid like $180 for it. Now, when I first got it, I'm messing around my apartment in pitch black with the night vision. And I noticed that the built-in light worked great for small rooms. But when you start getting to like a larger room, an auditorium, they suck. And it came with an external IR light that looked like a flashlight. But the problem was it was from outside the United States. So it had one of those really strained battery sizes. Mm-hmm. And I ended up getting a tactical IR light. It had the whole telescopic lens on it, high carbon steel body. I paid over $20 for this thing, but I threw that on my camera. And I'll talk a little bit more about this feature in a little bit, but I was able to turn off the internal light and use my external light. And I don't go anywhere without that flashlight because I could not believe how far I was able to get in the night vision with that. And I think that's something a lot of people don't quite get sometimes.
Yeah, now, it's important. Like the accessories you get with the camera, the features that are on the camera are another one. You want to make sure like that one you had, it looked like a lens doubler on the front of it. So yeah, you get a little bit more range out of it. You have manual focus is a must. And if you don't have a manual focus that you can touch, at least having that on the touch screen so that you can focus in and out. I know doing surveillance, a lot of times we were shooting through chain link fence and we had to focus the fence out to be able to see behind it. And you run into that on paranormal investigations a lot where maybe you run up against the edge of a property and you're like, what is that over there? I've got to zoom in on it. So you've got to be able to mess with that focus. Yeah. But lighting's super important, and it's a pretty simple fix. A lot of people run into it with podcasting too, getting like good lighting to where they get the look that they want. You don't have to spend, like we were doing surveillance. We were running cases that we were getting paid thousands of dollars, sometimes like a couple thousand dollars a day to go out and do surveillance. So yeah, we bought the $1,200 to $6,000 cameras, and we had the stream lights, the $150 flashlights. To do the IR stuff. Doing this, you don't have to spend that type of money to get very similar results. Like the camera you had was $100. You can pick up a one that's been modified. I believe it's the same brand from Ghost Stop for just a couple $100. And then, $20 for a flashlight that lets you see, a pretty good ways away as far as you're going to need to for a paranormal investigation. You don't have to spend a lot of money, but you do have to spend, if you don't spend the money on the resources, you don't get those professional or prosumer grade products. Instead of spending the money, you have to spend the time going through the features, and you have to spend the time going through and figuring out how to get the absolute best out of those pieces of equipment. So you're paying on one end. It's either time or money.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing that I learned with the video camera as I went along. I'd found out that, the first thing I was really happy with is that I could turn off the built-in IR light. Mm-hmm. And still be in IR mode, because there are some cameras out there that will not let you turn off that IR light in IR mode. And that can be frustrating because those kind of lights will eat up camera batteries like nothing. I've got, without the IR light, I can usually make a battery go about two and a half hours. But if I have that IR light on, my battery's only good for about 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. And it's ridiculous. And the other thing that I also learned is the camera, like you said, when you look at certain features, One of the things that I noticed with this is that my 4K, while the clarity was great, the frame rate wasn't what I thought it would be. Mm-hmm. But when I dropped it down into a standard 1080p, the frame rate was better, and the quality, while still good, it wasn't the same as the 4K. And I learned that with this camera, 4K only shoots in 30 frames per second, whereas the 1080 shot in 60 frames per second. Mm-hmm. So I kind of, you know, I kind of have to make the sacrifice, you know, yeah, I would love to be in 4K, but I switched to 1080 because then that made my slowdown on in the examination later so much cleaner. Mm-hmm.
And again, that's the it depends thing. So yeah. if you're getting serious about investigations, when it comes to video, like the most important thing with video over a stationary photo is the movement, because like, I don't want to use orbs, but like with orbs, you look at the movement to see if it's dust or a bug. Don't want to say anything's going to be a real orb there, but with shadows, with different things that are happening, to make sure it's not a glitch on the camera, that it's not a lighting trick or someone's not moving through there. The movement patterns are insanely important. So that's 60 frames per second, super important. So drop down in quality a little bit to get that. But if you're shooting something for social media and you're doing a channel, and this is where you're talking and being a person, that 4K really makes you pop, and 30 frames per second is optimal for social media and for doing uploads. So it depends on what you're doing.
Right. Raymond stopped by. Of course, you know, classic Raymond Newsom. If you ever get a chance to listen to him play games, you might learn a few ways to swear. And of course, we also have Matt Barron, the host of, you know, I'm not even sure what you got going on. He's got so many ideas. And he's just one of those guys that once you get that idea in his head, he's like a Jack Russell on it. He's not going to let go.
Matt, you know, all orbs are ghosts. Every single one of them. There's no such thing as dust. Bugs are a conspiracy. Orbs are all ghosts.
Watch it. Those are fighting words for some people. But, you know, in that, you know, speaking of orb, normally I try to stay away from the orb conversation. Yep. Just because of how I get, some people are very passionate about it. But yeah,
religion, politics, and orbs. That's what you stay away from.
Pretty much. And so there was this one guy on a group page, and he was posting things like, my neighborhood is so haunted. And he had this night vision security camera from outside his garage. And I'm looking at it, you know, at initial glance, if I didn't have a freaking clue about anything, I would have believed him. So many orbs, the whole neighborhood was filled with ghosts. But as an investigator and having learned my mistake, all I could think of was, okay, this guy is posting it right around spring. It's outside. So there's got to be pollen everywhere. You know, and if the humidity was up a little bit, that could certainly create a slew of orb, because I've seen that happen, especially here in Minnesota. You know, when you get around very small snowflakes. They're hard to pick up in a clear camera, but they tend to blur out. So that's where you kind of get the orb effect in Minnesota.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, so when I was first starting, there was a book out. It was called the Ghost Hunter's Guide. I've actually got it on my bookshelf right there. The Ghost Hunter's Guidebook by Troy Taylor. He also did a course at Flamel College on ghost hunting. So I did get to take that to get like a good base. Eventually I ended up working with him at the American Ghost Society. And in part of that class, we had to make fake ghost photos. So like at the time, this was back with film. This was back before digital cameras. Mm-hmm. So we had to use film. We also got into using infrared film, which is a massive pain in the ass if you've never used it. Basically like
it was a completely different set of chemicals.
No, it's a totally different process too. It's got to be refrigerated. It's got to be kept at a certain temperature at all times. It's very, very easy to screw that film up. It did screw up more often than not, but we had to make fake photos. Like we had to do orbs. So let's stir up a bunch of dust, turn the flash up and hit it. Let's do, we had to use reflections to create vortexes. So we did that and created fake photos that way. The camera strap, if you get the flash and you flash the camera strap in front of the lens fast enough, it gives this really cool glowing wave. It looks kind of like a proton pack, the stream that comes out of it. But we had to learn how to make all those fakes so that we could spot them when we were doing investigations. So that was pretty cool.
No. When you first started getting into the paranormal, and what was basically your starter set?
Yeah. So I started, I was about 16. So I got a car, and at the same time I got a car, I got, actually I've got it laying over here. My starter set was a Geiger counter.
Oh yeah.
Love that thing. A tri-field, EMF detector, I think it was Raytac, infrared thermometer. And I did a thermometer that I picked up from Radio Shack that had a probe so I could do the ambient temperature in two different rooms. And about four Sony high 8mm cameras.
Okay. Now that tri-field meter, that's the one that had the needle on it. Yeah. Okay. I remember those ones. Those, I've actually been trying to find like one that's from like the 80s because I was an 80s kid and I remember Ghostbusters coming out. And
it's in the other one.
So when I first started getting into the paranormal, the other thing that I struggled with was, okay, I have the videos and I have the pictures. How do I look at it? What do I use? Now, I'd already had some experience with Photoshop. Yeah, what was that?
This was the Raytac. So this was actually my very first infrared thermometer. Okay. And then this is the tri-field meter.
Yeah, those are the ones that I remember.
They're fantastic. They don't make these anymore. They have a digital version that's actually more sensitive and a better model than this. This still works. It's still calibrated. I haven't really had to do much maintenance to it. I still use it today. I've had this thing for almost 25 years.
Yeah, I mean, my sister gave me a Canon camera from the 70s. And all I can say is, holy shit, those things were monsters back then. You know?
Yeah.
You had to be unbelievably skilled with that camera because you didn't have memory cards. You just open the door, take the card out, put it in, boom, you're good to go. You had to load the film, you had to wind it, and then you had to, you know, before they came out with a motorized loader, you had to sit there and crank that thing after every shot. And that's the camera that I've got. And I've wanted to take it out, but I don't know anybody here in town that'll do film development. And I live in a really small one-bedroom apartment, so there's no way in hell my wife is going to let me take one of these rooms and make it a dark room.
Just set up curtains just to like make sure you duct tape the edges so like no light gets in there. Oh, man, yeah, well, I had a Rebel. It was a Canon Rebel. I don't remember it was like one of the first ones, I guess, from 2021 is when I got it. But okay. That was my first still camera that I used for investigations.
Yeah, well, see, my wife is already on me for being that crazy guy going on about conspiracies and stuff, though. She doesn't need to see a creepy curtained off section in the living room with red light glowing out of it somewhere. You know,
you get a chant when you're in there, though.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, that'll drive my neighbors up the wall.
Oh, I didn't realize I still had this. This is like the thermometer that I got 20 years ago. I've got a box here that's like all my original equipment.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, Radio Shack. This still works too. They used to make stuff to last.
Yeah. You know, and that's the thing. I go back to some of my old equipment too. I mean, stuff I have isn't that old chronologically, so to speak. It's just old because things, the trend changes every few months with technology, and it's moving so fast. So back to the whole thing with camera. What was some of the first software that you started using when you were examining your paranormal evidence?
The big stuff that I really examined was, so I used Photoshop, for photos. Now with photos, when I originally started, it wasn't software. You developed those photos and you went through with a magnifying glass and you sit there and you just went through, each of the photographs looking for something. If you needed it blown up, you go back to the photo lab and you show them what you want zoomed in on, and they would take the negative and they would blow that up from the negative. Yeah, kids, that's how we used to do it. Then I got into what was it? I think it was Photoshop, when Photoshop first started coming out, because that's how old I am to consumers. And for audio, I used Audacity, and I still use Audacity quite a bit, though I do a lot of my EVP work in WavePad now.
Okay, yeah, I have Audacity myself, and I used WavePad years ago before I. There was another program that came out. I can't even remember it, but I tried it out. But I definitely recommend Audacity or WavePad to anybody, because they both, for one, Audacity's free. And if you got a little bit of money, you could use WavePad, because WavePad got a really good user interface.
It does. And it's made for voices specifically. So if you're going through and you're trying to find cadence and you're trying to find speech, it works really, really well. I use it for editing my podcast. So I do actually the podcast, the actual editing, where I'm going through and I'm taking out the hiss and I'm taking out and I'm amplifying the audio. I do a lot of that in WavePad, and then I mix in Audacity.
Yeah. Now, I remember for Photoshop. I'm turning 50 next week. So I remember I remember when Photoshop first came out, and it wouldn't be until CS6 that I started to use it for paranormal investigation. And of course, now I've moved on to Affinity. Which is a very good runner-up for Photoshop. If for those people who may be kind of on a tight budget and can't really afford, you know, don't want to have to deal with the Adobe subscription, right now Affinity is running a promo where you can get access to all three of their programs for 6 months for free, which will give you plenty of time to, you know, especially Affinity Photo. Which is what I started using when I'm trying to examine my paranormal photos. And I like that it's not quite so complex with the user interface when dealing with, like, you know, exposure, contrast, adjusting color correction. And when you started working with Photoshop, how long did it take you to get comfortable with it to have some sort of, you know, confidence in the evidence that you were getting?
Not too long. It's pretty basic when I first started, first got into it and started using it. And I didn't use it for very long. I moved away from doing a lot of still stuff, into doing more video. But yeah, not too long. The more you play with it, the faster you pick it up. I'd say probably, like, thinking back, it was a long time ago, thinking back, probably maybe a couple weeks before I started feeling really, really comfortable with it. Now, I don't do a lot of changes. Coming from an investigation background, even in high school, I went to a high school where we were able to major and knock out the first little bit of college in those last couple of years. I specialized in I majored in legal and protective studies. So they're very big on when you're collecting evidence for an investigative purpose, you want to alter it as little as possible. So, like, I would zoom into it, I would blow it up, I would look at things. Now, this was back, digital cameras back then were not what they are today. No. So you could only enhance so much before everything started looking like, what is that game? Minecraft.
Yes. The pixelated look.
Yep. Now with film cameras, something that was really cool that they started doing was they started putting your film cameras on a disc so you could put it in the computer. Those you could get a little bit more mileage out of, but still analog photos did not have the resolution that the digital photos have today.
Yeah. Well, I remember when I first started working with photo, I was surprised at how easy it was to completely destroy something in an image when you're trying to, you know, like with Photoshop Express, they have a feature on there. Well, all Photoshop does and all digital editing programs do. But when I first started working with adjusting the sharpness, it worked great for a very narrow spot, because it's a very small threshold, because it you can over sharpen it and you'll start getting all sorts of digital anomalies in there that look like it might be evident, but it's not. It's just because something was just over sharpened that it became distorted somehow. And in your experience, what has been the most difficult part of examining evidence for you?
Trying to think back when, with doing photos, because I don't do photos a whole lot anymore.
Well, photos or video.
The hardest thing is how time consuming it is. So like, especially if we're doing video, we're doing visual evidence. When we run across something, trying to figure out if it's really there. And then when you start trying to enhance it, like, so you start going into the video, you start blowing things up, you pull a still shot from it and you start going through and you start, playing around with contrast, playing around with the brightness, playing around with, trying to make whatever you think is in that shadow pop. And like you're saying, you can totally create something. So the biggest struggle with actually going through evidence isn't the technical side of it. It's not letting my imagination run away with me and see things that aren't there, or get really, really focused on something that I can barely see and manipulate it to the point that I create something that wasn't there.
Yes. And, you know, I've done that on site without the camera, you just using my own eyes. You know, you get into a place that doesn't have a whole lot of light and your flashlight starts to, we know the angle of flashlight against object can create some pretty strange shadows, especially around reflective surfaces. Mm-hmm. You know, that probably one of the most challenging things for me, because I have a problem with glare. Where a glare might mess up most people, it messes me up twice as bad. And so I started to work with video, and that's, you know, that's why I asked earlier about, you know, what are some of the things that you would bring with you to help maintain the best chances of obtaining a very clean still or video. And for me, one of the things would be, you know, any kind of lens cleaner, but you don't want something that's petroleum-based, because I found that petroleum-based lens cleaners, you have a very high chance of getting streaks. And sometimes you can get some pretty good lens cleaners that's not petroleum-based from Walmart. They don't cost much. But it is something that, you know, you should look into when you're trying to make sure your lenses are always clean. When I first started, I just, you know, breathe on the lens and take a shirt and just wipe it. And I'd be arguing with that lens for 15 minutes before I finally got it clean enough to use.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. So which video software do you use when examining your videos?
So I've used Adobe before. I actually still use the one that I used to... that I used to use when I was an investigator. It's on my desktop. I keep forgetting the name. Investigation Video Editor. It was a software that was designed by a private investigator. It allows you to overlay time and date stamps. So most camcorders, and this is the reason why I like using Canon and Sony specifically, in the metadata of the video, it has the time and date. So when I put it through Investigation Video Editor, it takes that metadata and stamps it onto the video so that I have in my files a running time and date stamp. I think some of the newer cameras will actually put that on there for you, but this one just makes sure that it's in there. It allows me to speed things up, slow it down, you know, all stuff that you can do with video, but it also allows me to very easily pull still shots and to blow those things up and fix those. Like get the best resolution I can out of the still shot and really go through and examine those. Now, pulling a still image from video is not ideal because it is going to be more pixelated than using a regular regular camera. But having that tool has been just incredible. And I know Adobe will go a little bit deeper. I do not have the Adobe subscriptions right now just because they are so ridiculous and I don't have the return on the financial side from using it. So I don't use those, but yeah, my process is pretty simple. I try not to get into too much other than lightening or darkening the video and playing with that. Same thing with audio. If it isn't readily apparent to the naked eye, I throw it out. If it's not like class A, then it's gone, especially with audio, going through and doing audio through WavePad and Audacity, because you can tweak, and audio is the same way as video or pictures. You can tweak that to the point to where you end up playing with the cadence of the static, and you can create words. I create sound effects for my podcasts and stuff doing that. It's sound engineering.
Right.
And the same thing with video and with pictures. If you play with the contrast enough, if you play with the brightness enough, and you get in, you start tweaking and you zoom in and you're manipulating things and doing edits to the actual image, you can create stuff that isn't there. So if I'm going through and it's not readily apparent there's a dude standing there, there's right. some sort of weird shape that should not be there. I don't have an explanation for it. I don't count it as evidence.
Right. Now, one thing that I've done is when people say, give me an image and, hey, I want you to check this out. The one image that I don't like getting are one where they already circled the location they want me to look at. Because I feel like if there's something there, you know, like you said, just a couple of tweaks here and there, if I don't see something right away, chances are there's really nothing there. Mm-hmm. You know, and no, I totally agree. If people don't see it on their own without being told where it is, it's not that good of an evidence. Mm-hmm. Now, when it comes to using your cell phone, where do you sit with using cell phones for a ghost hunting equipment besides just video or photos and audio?
I don't. I know app designers and going through and looking at the way a lot of those are designed. Most of the ones people are using for communication or for ghost photos, they have a program running that gives you responses, and it looks at the GPS signal from the phone, and it looks at where you are in your cellular data. It listens to your phone calls. And it will, in your conversations around the phone, and it will give you answers to questions, and they will give you things that are based specifically on the place where you're standing or somewhere nearby. So because of that, because those apps, even if they're not upfront about having that capability, they have that capability. And that's a really easy explanation that would debunk it. So I don't use them at all. Now, voice memo for doing EVPs. Yeah, that's a voice recorder. I'll use that for doing EVPs. There's a very, very simple EMF app, and it uses one of the sensors in your phone that does actually work as an EMF meter. It is nowhere near as accurate as an actual handheld unit, an actual EMF meter, but in a pinch, it will show you anomalies. It will help you debunk and find speakers hidden in walls or find lines going somewhere where there's not supposed to be. So that one's useful. And then the camera, I mean, the cameras are getting a lot better if you know how to use them. I still think that, cell phone cameras are, your last option. If you're somewhere that you can't get a camcorder into or a camera into, or you're on vacation, you end up staying in a hotel and, oh, I didn't realize this was haunted. Cool. I want to shoot some video and do some stuff. Yeah. And EMFs on the phone recorder and using the phone video.
Are there any specific audio recorders that you would recommend?
I'm trying to think. Yeah. Zoom makes a lot of really good ones. The H4 is one that I highly recommend because you can run multiple. It's got XLRs. It's a handheld, and the recording quality is fantastic. It's expensive. But it is worth it. And I always forget the name of the other one, but I can pull that up. The Zoom H4 is one of the big ones. People use it for podcasting. And what's great is if you're running audio experiments, you can plug in different microphones. So you can run an XLR cable in with a mic to a bass microphone or to a dynamic microphone and to a condenser microphone. And you can start doing things with microphones that are tuned to specific frequencies to see where those EVPs are coming from.
Right. Well, so that's definitely something I'd be interested in, you know, because I mean, with my experience with podcasts and stand up and, you know, working with different types of microphones, you know, dynamic and condensers. Mm-hmm. Which one would you, if somebody wanted to get an external mic to be able to plug into a recording unit, which one would you recommend be the better option, a dynamic or a condenser?
For EVPs?
Yes. Because I kind of feel like with a condenser, you might lose a little something because it both to minimize certain background noises, if I'm not mistaken. Well, not mistaken. You don't hear much of the background noise.
The Zoom H1 is another one that I would recommend. There's another one. You can find them on GhostStop. I wanted to look that up. Oh, Tascam. Any of the Tascam recorders are fantastic. That was the company that I was looking for. Sorry, I got off on that and I wanted to look it up. condenser or dynamic? It depends. So the thing with condenser microphones are they are much, much more sensitive than dynamic mics. They do pick up more background noise. They are more susceptible to electronic interference. But there's a theory that when it comes to EVPs, that the spirit is actually, there's an exposed copper component inside of the microphone. The sound and the stimulus goes across that. It's digitized, and that's where the sound comes from into the computer. Okay. So they believe a signal is hitting that. With a dynamic microphone, it reacts to sound waves and vocals. So there's a theory that if it's captured with a dynamic microphone, it's actually a disembodied voice that you just didn't hear at the time. Whereas a condenser mic would pick up an EVP from the spirit actually interacting with the device itself like a true ICT, like a similar to a spirit box. We don't know how any of this works, but it is very interesting to run experiments with a dynamic mic and a condenser mic at the same time, because you do get very different recordings from it.
Right. Yeah, that's one thing I've noticed with, I'm pretty sure that the microphone on my video camera is not the same one that's in my handheld, which I think it's an Olympus. It's a Walmart brand. You know, $30. Have you ever come across anything in your audio that, you know, you don't know if it's paranormal or just, you know, unexplainable, but it's just so bizarre?
Yeah. Recently, actually, if you check out the latest episode of Ghost Hunter Advice, I went back and I found my Spirit Box episode. And toward the end of that, I have some recordings on that I got from the Spirit Box. I did not hear those at the time. And so I ran the Spirit Box and I ran an external recorder and asked the questions. So there are some of those. There's one in particular that came across the box. But there were several that I'm not really sure if that was Spirit Box communication or if it was an EVP, or if maybe it could have been cell phone interference. But I had this one, and it was very, very clear. I'm at a mass gravesite. 112 people, I think, were buried in this grave. And very, very distinctly, it comes across and says, "We're buried." And that was there. It's a Confederate cemetery, and that's on that podcast episode.
I'm definitely going to check that out. I mean, you know, anything that deals with something historic like that, definitely right up my alley. But one reason why I asked is because one of my earliest investigations was of a cemetery here in Elk River called Arono Cemetery. And this has a veteran from the War of 1812 buried there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course, every other subsequent war after that. But I'm over there and you can hear in the recording, Tom and I were talking to each other, you know, asking the questions, things like, you know, what was it like for you back then? Just random stuff. But you can also hear that Tom and I are not hearing anything with our own ears. Mm-hmm. But it wouldn't be until like 2 months later, I finally get around to loading it up into Audacity. It starts off real faint, and I'm not exactly sure when it begins because you can kind of hear the ambient background noise of the wind, the trees, and things like that. But sure enough, you hear old-timey piano music.
Oh, that's nuts. The kind of music
here in the saloon. Mm-hmm. and it just got a little bit louder and louder. And finally it got to a volume level, but it was still pretty low. And then it just stopped. Mm-hmm. Now, there's, as far as I know, this hand recorder is not set up to receive radio signal. What would you think?
It was an Olympus.
Yes.
So I've had this happen with Olympus recorders. I actually had this happen with Sony's and a couple others too. So I started doing EVP experiments in this Confederate graveyard, just mm-hmm. because. One of the reasons was there's a cell tower very, very near to that location. And the consumer grade recorders, that's one of the reasons I like the Zoom. It is quite a bit more expensive, but it's shielded properly against cell phone interference. Okay. We were picking up cell phone conversations from the cell tower. It's not set up to get radio signals, but sometimes it does. But what radio station is going to be playing old timey piano music?
Yeah, I mean, when I was listening to it, my initial reaction was the saloon of like the late 1800s, early 1900s. Mm-hmm. It's just that kind of ragtime piano. And that's been bugging me. I mean, it's been 5 years, you know, because I'm the kind of guy, like, I can either explain it, or it's just plain unexplainable, or it's paranormal. I mean, I like to have those things in those three neat categories. That recording, I still don't know where exactly to put that thing, because it's, you know, I've never heard anything like it. And people that I've talked with, they've never heard anything like it either. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Oh, there was I got an EVP saying my name, Tanner. And it was very, very loud. It sounded like somebody was in the room with me. And I remember I was reviewing that the day after the investigation. I threw my headphones across the room. I was like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
And I found that file. I was going through and I was getting rid of some of the PI files that I have left that needed to be destroyed. And I ran across that because that file got slipped into the filing cabinet. And I was like, oh, cool. So I started pulling out the photos, like the old... like physical photos and the negatives. Right. And I just sat down and started looking through them, and I missed something. This was during one of my first years as an investigator. And I was flipping through and I noticed something in the corner. So I got the old magnifying glass out and I set it on top of the photo. I started going, and damn it, there was a dude in the house. And I recognized him as one of the client's teenage sons. Apparently, I was alone on the property, but apparently he had snuck in, and just one of the photos got him crouched, because this is back when I did lights out, blackout investigations. Right. And, he was crouched over there and he was just screwing with me. So I had to throw throwing all that out. I was like, oh man, 20 plus years later, case closed.
So, this is kind of a really weird question, and I'll just kind of think this might be an interesting way to kind of close out the show. Where do you stand with this psychic phenomenon?
Undecided. So, are you talking specifically about mediums, or are you talking about like the full range of the dead people come back and we can talk to them?
Kind of a full range.
I don't know. I think the world is a lot weirder than we give it credit for. I do think there's been enough investigations that I've gone on that I do think that there is something that's left behind. There is some sort of psychic imprint, something that could live on. I think a lot of our mood, a lot of our personality is shaped by the biological aspects. So we stabilize our moods with hormones and the physical parts of our brains, but our thoughts and memories are... thought to be these electrical impulses inside of they call it quantum phenomenon inside of the tubules of the brain. So
yeah, I was reading about that.
Mm-hmm. And I think consciousness is a 50-50 split between that or some sort of split between that. So the part of us that lives on, the energy that lives on after death, I'm not sure how much of me, my personality, my emotions and the things that make me human, I'm not sure how much of that goes with the energy that lives on. So that's that's a back and forth, but yeah, I think there's something to it. I think that there are multiple explanations for hauntings. I don't think we're looking at just one thing. You know, right. Stone tape theory could explain one thing. The remnants of a person was left behind after death could explain something else. Sometimes I think there's places where we actually cause the hauntings ourselves and we're haunting ourselves. Somehow there's something about the environment there, or something about the person that allows them to manifest things, even though they might not be aware of it. I think there's multiple explanations, and this is a very complex issue and not something that can be answered with one clean yes, ghosts right. are the dead.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and one of the reasons why I asked that is because I had one case. There was a legend at a park not too far from where I live, and the legend was that a woman was killed and her eyes were down the sink, and then "Help me" was written in blood on the mirror in one of the old public bathrooms out there. And that building has since been torn down. The park has been renovated, but, you know, the building they put in place of the original bathroom, it's still a bathroom, we're starting to get the same thing. And people were saying, you know, yeah, we're seeing eyes and the blood on the mirror. And I don't even remember how long I researched that case, but eventually I found an essay written by a guy explaining how he pulled this prank back in the 80s. When he was out fishing, he just took fish eyes, put them on the sink, and wrote "Help me" in fish blood on the mirror. So there was never a murder there, but people were still getting paranormal evidence out there. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, and it was, you know, and I like how you mentioned that, you know, it's possible that people may be projecting that themselves, which is what I think is happening here, because they heard this story over and over for years, and every kid hears about it, and, you know, that gets locked into that mindset of that community, everybody's going to have a paranormal experience.
Mm-hmm. And it's focused belief. So like, it might not even be just right. one person causing the manifestation. We look at tulpas, we look at the, you know, the thought forms, the Philip experiment. And if you have an entire town that believes in a legend, it doesn't matter if that place is haunted. It doesn't matter if the crime or the event actually took place there. There's a good possibility you're going to get something happening there that matches that local legend, just because there's so much focused belief there that I think sometimes it takes on a life of its own.
And that, like I said, I think that's kind of what happened with Sturgis Park. Mm-hmm. You know, because, you know, again, you have a guy who said, "I pulled a prank." So you would think that with that revelation, they would stop, but apparently not.
Well, fish eyes.
Yeah. Well, we are at that 1 hour mark, and I know you got some kids that need to be put to sleep. Mm-hmm. Is there anything you got coming up that you want to give a shout out to? Upcoming shows,
events? We got a couple. So I'm going to be live with Matt Barron tomorrow here on Parapost at 8 o'clock Eastern. We're going to be going over teaching and mentoring in the paranormal field. Why is it so important? And why aren't we doing more of it? I think it's time for us to start sharing information, and especially for those of us who are starting to get up there in the years, helping the new people coming in to get off on the right foot. So we'll be talking about that. We'll be talking about, ways that you can mentor and ways you can be mentored. And then I'll be doing my podcaster help desk, Saturday at 2 PM on, Eastern on Parapost. That's where basically I just go over industry news that's happening in content creation and the paranormal, podcasting world, talk about, different, ways to market, ways to grow your show. Or if you are having issues with your audio, if you want to sound better, you're having some problems with, you know, planning content, anything that goes around your show and entertaining people, right. You can hop on there live and, I'll troubleshoot your audio for you. And, we can talk about your content and different ways to connect with your audience.
All right. Well, if you want to check out, any of his other stuff, I do have his links in the description. They are the first two links for Killer Pro Podcast, as well as Ghost Hunting Advice. So check them out, show them support, and yeah, definitely take a swing by tomorrow and catch his appearance on Matt Barron's show. Yeah, it's been great having you here with me, Tanner. I definitely want to get you back on, you know, when I start doing more shows dealing with tech and stuff like this, because I love this kind of stuff. And if we can help the paranormal field, you know, get a little bit better credibility, I'm always for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you got to, like, having the equipment's great. Knowing how to use it, that's what makes or breaks an investigation.
All right. Well, hang out in the green room real quick while I wrap this up real quick, and we'll talk a little bit further about what happened after this.
Cool.
And again, thanks for stopping by.
Hey, thanks for having me, man. Bye, guys.
All right. All right. Well, that's it, ladies and gentlemen, for That Weird Show. And I will be doing some more episodes like this about tech, and I will be getting him back on. And if you want to be on the show and join the conversation and maybe even bring some of your photos and videos and to share it, please reach out to me, and I'd be more than happy to get you on That Weird Show. I want to hear your story. And as I always say at the end of every show, be smart, be safe, and be kind to one another, because you never know, your one act of kindness might change somebody's life. And as always, stay weird.